grew up together in three particular towns as friends, says director Havana Marking, who helped uncover the story in her documentary Smash and Grab. The experience of going through the communist regime and then the free-for-all nightmare of the war that followed, that really bonded them. They were mostly smugglers at the beginning, to survive. They worked together in those environments, and it wasn't for money, it was for survival. They learned how to fake documents and cross borders, as well as other skills. They were attracted to adrenaline and action. You have to understand that crime in the Balkans was a normal life. If what happened in the Balkans hadn't happened, these people probably would have been entrepreneurs, lawyers, and journalists. Each team was built around a set of well-defined roles. There was a zavodnik, a seducer, who scouts the location, usually a woman, a magadi, or muscle for getting the jewels, a jatak, who arranged logistics. While there were leaders on each team, they did not issue orders. Instead, they operated according to a simple rule that one panther explained to Marking. We all depend on each other. This interdependence began with the way the panthers prepared for each robbery. Each team member, there were never more than five or six on a team, moved to the city and gathered information on the target store. They lived and worked together for weeks of intensive planning. They scouted the store, tracked the comings and goings of the employees, and sketched maps of the layout to target the most valuable gems. What's more, each panther shared the cost of the planning, which was not insignificant. The advance costs for the Tokyo robbery were $100,000. They did not rely on any outside structure or safety net. They were the structure, and if any of them failed, the group would fail. In other words, the panthers were a little bit like comedians doing a Herald, or SEALs doing log PT. Small teams solving problems in a constant state of vulnerability and interconnection. As one panther named Leela told Marking, "My one mistake would be their fall. If I make an error somewhere, they are doomed." For her film, Marking interviewed a man and woman who were formerly on the same panther team but hadn't seen each other in some years. She watched how they interacted. "They hadn't seen each other for a long time, and they were really happy to see each other," she says. "They had a proper friendship and seemed to be genuinely close. You know how you can sense when two people are completely relaxed in each other's company? You could sense it with them." 10. How to create cooperation in small groups. Dave Cooper's rules. If you were to seek out the highest performing teams on the planet, at some point, you would find yourself in Dam Neck, Virginia, home base for Draper Kaufman's descendants, the 300 Navy SEALs who make up Team 6. And if you were to ask a variety of current and retired Team 6 operators which leaders they admire most, you would hear the same handful of names over and over. But the name you would hear most often is Dave Cooper. This is a surprising choice, because Dave Cooper does not possess any obvious talents that distinguish him from the rest of Team 6. Cooper, who retired in 2012, is neither the smartest nor the strongest team member, nor the best marksman. He is not the best swimmer, nor the best at close quarters combat. But he happens to be the best at a skill that is at once hard to define and immensely valuable. He's the best at creating great teams. Coop is a very intelligent guy who stayed in the trenches for a long time, says former Team 6 operator Christopher Baldwin. He wasn't one of those people who moved up the leadership chain just to move up. He's one of us. He understood the bigger picture, and you could always talk to him. "There are some higher-ups who've had run-ins with him, and he doesn't always follow the rules," says another operator. "But if you're on his team, you can see why he's effective." Another operator puts it more succinctly. "Cooper is the dude." They tell me how Cooper worked in Bosnia, Somalia, Iraq, and Afghanistan. always in places that were sporty, to use the SEAL term. They tell me how well Cooper's teams worked together and how often they succeeded when things went to hell, especially when they went to hell. The more they talk, the more Cooper expands in my imagination to become a larger-than-life figure, a combination of Vince Lombardi and Jason Bourne. Then, at a restaurant in Virginia Beach, we meet for lunch. Cooper turns out to be a medium-sized guy in a beach shirt, shorts, and flip-flops, who in most aspects resembles a suburban dad. As you might expect, he is extremely fit. As you might not expect, he is chatty and warm, with eyebrows that steeple together in concern when he listens. Like most SEAL operators, he carries himself with his elbows slightly away from his body, radiating awareness, scanning the room. Controlling the space, this is called. He picks an outside table, so we can see the crowd. He chats with the waiter, listening to the specials with warm intensity. Then the eyebrows steeple. "So, what do you want to know?" he asks. Cooper's backstory, like that of most Team Six guys, is idiosyncratic. He was raised in small-town Pennsylvania and grew up wanting to be a doctor. He majored in molecular biology at Juniata College, a tiny liberal arts school that allowed military recruiters on campus just one day a year. He heard of the SEALs from a history teacher and could still recite the line that hooked him. "SEALs are highly intelligent, copious readers." He was fascinated, and after graduation, he made his way to training. He survived Hell Week, passed Draper Kaufman's selection process, and made it through another selection to join Team Six in 1993. There are many stories Cooper can tell, and many he cannot, about life as a Team Six operator. But when you ask him about building teams, he tells only one story. It happened in Afghanistan on New Year's Eve 2001, on a desolate road between Bagram and Jalalabad. Cooper was on that road because he had received an order to accompany his commander on a 4-person route reconnaissance mission in which they would drive from Bagram to Jalalabad and back in a single day. The road was a nightmare, an explosive-infested, often impassable, 110-mile stretch populated by bandits and insurgents. But Cooper's commander insisted they go, exuding confidence as he outlined the plan. They would ride in an armored Suburban with specially reinforced tires. They would be fast and stealthy. Everything would be fine. Cooper held his doubts, followed rank, and went along. From the first miles out of Bagram, things started to go sideways. The road turned out to be worse than expected, in places more like a hiking trail than a highway. The ground clearance on the armored Suburban was only a few inches, so they were slowed to a crawl much of the time. By nightfall, when they finally reached Jalalabad, Cooper figured they would stay and wait for daylight. Instead, the commander announced they would be turning around and driving back to Bagram that night so they could complete the mission as planned. Cooper objected. "That was a bad idea," he said. The discussion got heated. Cooper and his commander yelled back and forth before the commander finally invoked his rank. Cooper submitted. With a sinking feeling, he climbed in the Suburban, and the group set off into the night. The ambush happened an hour later. A convoy of trucks and jeeps rumbled out of the blackness and surrounded the Suburban. Cooper's driver tried to escape, but the reinforced tires blew out. They were driving on rims, in the dark, with gunfire arriving from all directions. One SEAL operator was bleeding, shot through the leg. It was, as Cooper says, an unmitigated shit show. The SEALs had no choice but to surrender, climbing out with their arms raised, sure they were about to be killed. "For some reason, they decided not to shoot us," Cooper says. "Either they were scared of retaliation, or they saw that we weren't much of a threat." The insurgents roared off into the darkness, carrying the SEALs' weapons. Cooper and his team were able to contact Delta and British Special Forces units, which flew in to rescue them a few hours later. He returned to Bagram with a second chance and a new worldview. "That night put me on a different path," Cooper says. "From that moment on, I realized that I needed to figure out ways to help the group function more effectively. The problem here is that, as humans, we have an authority bias that's incredibly strong and unconscious. If a superior tells you to do something, by God, we tend to follow it, even when it's wrong. Having one person tell other people what to do is not a reliable way to make good decisions. So how do you create conditions where that doesn't happen, where you develop a hive mind? How do you develop ways to challenge each other, ask the right questions, and never defer to authority? We're trying to create leaders among leaders, and you can't just tell people to do that. You have to create the conditions where they start to do it." Starting that night in 2001, Cooper set out to build those conditions for his teams. His approach to nurturing cooperation could be described as an insurgent campaign against authority bias. Merely creating space for cooperation, he realized, wasn't enough. He had to generate a series of unmistakable signals that tipped his men away from their natural tendencies and toward interdependence and cooperation. "Human nature is constantly working against us," he says. "You have to get around those barriers, and they never go away." He started with small things. A new team member who called him by his title was quickly corrected. "You can call me Coop, Dave, or Fuckface. It's your choice." When Cooper gave his opinion, he was careful to attach phrases that provided a platform for someone to question him, like, "Now let's see if someone can poke holes in this," or, "Tell me what's wrong with this idea." He steered away from giving orders and instead asked a lot of questions. "Anybody have any ideas?" During missions, Cooper sought opportunities to spotlight the need for his men to speak up, especially with newer team members. He was not subtle. "For example, when you're in an urban environment, windows are bad," he tells me. "You stand in front of one and you can get shot by a sniper and never know where it came from. So if you're a new guy and you see me standing in front of a window in Fallujah, what are you going to say? Are you going to tell me to move my ass? Or are you going to stand there quietly and let me get shot?" When I ask new guys that question, they say, "I'll tell you to move." So I tell them, "Well, that's exactly how you should conduct yourself all the time around here, with every single decision." Cooper began to develop tools. "There are things you can do," he says. "Spending time together outside, hanging out, those help. One of the best things I've found to improve a team's cohesion is to send them to do some hard, hard training. There's something about hanging off a cliff together and being wet and cold and miserable together that makes a team come together." One of the most useful tools was the after-action review, the truth-telling session we referenced in Chapter 7. AARs happen immediately after each mission and consist of a short meeting in which the team gathers to discuss and replay key decisions. AARs are led not by commanders, but by enlisted men. There are no agendas and no minutes are kept. The goal is to create a flat landscape without rank, where people can figure out what really happened and talk about mistakes, especially their own. "It's gotta be safe to talk," Cooper says. "Rank switched off, humility switched on. You're looking for that moment where people can say, 'I screwed that up.' In fact, I'd say those might be the most important four words any leader can say. 'I screwed that up.'" Good AARs follow a template. "You have to do it right away," Cooper says. "You put down your gun, circle up, and start talking. Usually you take the mission from beginning to end, chronologically. You talk about every decision, and you talk about the process. You have to resist the temptation to wrap it all up in a bow and try to dig for the truth of what happened, so people can really learn from it. You have to ask why, and then when they respond, you ask another why. 'Why did you shoot at that particular point?' What did you see? How did you know? What other options were there? You ask and ask and ask. The goal of an AAR is not to excavate truth for truth's sake, or to assign credit and blame, but rather to build a shared mental model that can be applied to future missions. Look, nobody can see it all or know it all, Cooper says. But if you keep getting together and digging out what happened, then after a while, everybody can see what's really happening, not just their small piece of it. People can share experiences and mistakes. They can see how what they do affects others, and we can start to create a group mind where everybody can work together and perform to the team's potential. Cooper uses the phrase backbone of humility to describe the tone of a good AAR. It's a useful phrase because it captures the paradoxical nature of the task, a relentless willingness to see the truth and take ownership. With an AAR, as with Log PT or a Herald, group members have to combine discipline with openness. And as with a Log PT or a Herald, it's not easy, but it does pay off. After his revelation on the road to Bagram, Cooper spent the next decade leading teams, mostly in the Middle East. He gradually rose to Team 6's highest enlisted rank of Command Master Chief, which placed him in charge of the entire group's training. In March 2011, he and another Team 6 leader were summoned by Admiral William McRaven, commander of Joint Special Operations Command, to CIA headquarters in McLean, Virginia. McRaven got right to the point. "We think we've found Osama bin Laden." He then outlined the plan. Team 6 operators would fly into Pakistan in stealth helicopters, fast rope onto the compound's roof, and kill the Al-Qaeda leader. Cooper listened, his attention drawn to one element, the stealth helicopters. He knew they were attractive to McRaven because they were invisible to radar, and would thus allow the team to travel undetected through Pakistani airspace. But Cooper also knew they were untested in combat, and that special ops history was littered with disasters caused by using untested tools in combat. So he spoke up. "With all due respect, sir," Cooper said, "I would not use those helicopters on this mission. I would plan something else in parallel. If we can't go with something else, then I go with the helicopters." "We're not changing the plan now," McRaven said. Cooper decided to keep pushing. He wanted to get this on the table. "Sir, I'd be remiss if I didn't tell you what I thought." McRaven raised his voice. "We're not changing the plan now," he said. In that moment, I was pretty sure I was getting fired, Cooper tells me later. But I wasn't going to keep my mouth shut. He pushed again. McRaven shut him down again. The discussion was over. Cooper walked out of that room facing a problem. How do you follow an order that carries what you consider to be an unacceptably high risk? In essence, he was in precisely the same position he'd been in back on the road to Bagram on New Year's Eve 2001. Should he follow the order or defy it? Cooper chose a third path. He accepted the use of the stealth helicopters and also started preparing in case they failed. In the ensuing weeks, the SEALs built replicas of bin Laden's compound in North Carolina, Nevada, and Afghanistan. In each place, Cooper ran downed helicopter scenarios over and over. He simulated crashes outside the compound, inside the compound, on the roof, in the yard, hundreds of yards away. Each was essentially the same. Partway through the operation, Cooper would surprise the team with the order, "You're going down, now." The pilots would auto-rotate the helicopter to the ground, and the team would then attack the mock compound from wherever they happened to be. There were never any right or wrong answers. They had to self-organize and deal with the problem, Cooper said. "Then we'd do an AAR, talk about it, and figure out what had happened and what we could do better next time." The downed helicopter drills were not easy. They demanded a high level of attention, cooperation, and improvisation. In the AARs that followed each drill, the team members repeatedly went over what went wrong, owned mistakes, and talked about how they might do it better. "We ran so many that it became a joke among the guys," Cooper says. They were saying, "Hey, Coop, can we please run another downed helicopter scenario?" On May 1st, the White House sent the order to launch. The two stealth helicopters lifted off from the U.S. airbase in Jalalabad. At the base's command center, Cooper, McRaven, and other commanders gathered around the screen to watch the drone video feed. In the White House, President Barack Obama and his national security team leaned in, watching the same images. The mission started smoothly. They made it through Pakistani airspace undetected and approached bin Laden's compound. But as the first helicopter attempted to land, things went wrong. One helicopter skidded around in the air as if it were on ice, veering and spinning toward the ground. The other helicopter, which was supposed to land on the roof of the main compound, saw the problems and veered off to land outside. The explanation that later emerged was that the high walls of the compound created downdrafts that disrupted flight. The rehearsals had all been done at mock-up compounds with chain-link fence, not solid walls. Then things got worse. The first pilot, unable to keep altitude, crash-landed in the courtyard, lodging the tail section on the wall and tipping the helicopter on its side, burying its nose in the soft dirt. In the command post, the general stared wordlessly at the screen. For 3 or 4 seconds, the room filled with an unbearable silence. Then they saw it. Team 6 operators pouring out of the downed helicopter, just as they had in the drills, going to work. They got moving and started working the problem. Pickup basketball at its finest. "They didn't miss a beat," Cooper says. Once they got on the ground, there was zero doubt. 38 minutes later, it was over, and the entire planet had an opportunity to appreciate the team's skill and bravery. But in all the celebration, it's easy to miss the deeper skill, the chain of training and AARs that laid the foundation for that moment. From afar, the bin Laden raid looked like a demonstration of team strength, power, and control. But that strength was built of a willingness to spot and confront the truth and to come together to ask a simple question over and over. What's really going on here? Cooper and his team did not have to go back again and again to work on downed helicopter scenarios. But they succeeded because they understood that being vulnerable together is the only way a team can become invulnerable. "When we talk about courage, we think it's going against an enemy with a machine gun," Cooper says. "The real courage is seeing the truth and speaking the truth to each other. People never want to be the person who says, 'Wait a second, what's really going on here?' But inside the squadron, that is the culture. And that's why we're successful." 11. How to create cooperation with individuals. The Nyquist method. Back in the early part of the last century, well before Silicon Valley, the world's foremost hub of invention and innovation was located in a series of large, nondescript buildings in suburban New Jersey. It was called Bell Labs. Originally formed in 1925 to help build a national communications network, Bell Labs grew into the scientific equivalent of Renaissance-era Florence, a wellspring of group genius that lasted until the 1970s. Led by Claude Shannon, a brilliant polymath who liked to ride through the halls on his unicycle while juggling, Bell Labs and its teams of scientists invented and developed the transistor, data networking, solar cells, lasers, communication satellites, binary computing, and cellular communication. In short, most of the tools we use to live modern life. Midway through that golden age, some Bell Labs administrators grew curious about the reasons for their own remarkable success. They wondered which Bell scientists had generated the most patents for their inventions, and whether those scientists had anything in common. They began by examining the Bell Patent Library, where patents were kept in binders organized alphabetically by the scientist's last name. Most of the binders were about the same size, recalls Bill Kefauver, a lawyer who worked in the patent office. But some binders stood out right away because they were fat, much fatter than everyone else's. Those were the super creative people who had filed dozens and dozens of patents. There were about 10 of them. The administrators studied those 10 scientists, hunting for the common thread. Did the super creatives share the same specialty? The same educational background? The same family background? After considering and discarding dozens of possible ties, they discovered a connection, and it didn't have to do with who the super creatives were. It had to do with a habit that they shared. The habit of regularly eating lunch in the Bell Labs cafeteria with a quiet Swedish engineer named Harry Nyquist. This result came as a surprise, to say the least. Not because Nyquist wasn't well known. He was, having pioneered important advances in telegraphy and feedback amplification. But in a place famous for its dynamic and eccentric leaders, Nyquist was the opposite. A mild, gently smiling Lutheran, known mostly for his tranquil reliability. Raised on a Swedish farm, he approached his work with old-world discipline. He awoke at precisely 6:45 each morning, departed for the office at precisely 7:30, and was always home for family dinner at 6:15. His most idiosyncratic habit was occasionally taking the ferry instead of the subway on his commute home. He enjoyed the fresh air. He was so ordinary as to be nearly invisible. In other words, the most important person in one of the most creative places in history turned out to be the person almost everyone would overlook, which is why it's important to look a bit more closely at his skill set. Nyquist, by all accounts, possessed two important qualities. The first was warmth. He had a knack for making people feel cared for. Every contemporary description paints him as fatherly. The second quality was a relentless curiosity. In a landscape made up of diverse scientific domains, he combined breadth and depth of knowledge with a desire to seek connections. Nyquist was full of ideas, full of questions, Bell Labs engineer Chapin Cutler recalls. He drew people out, got them thinking. Nyquist was good at a particular kind of activity that Bell really encouraged in those days, Kefauver says. People in all kinds of disciplines, on all kinds of projects, talking about their project with someone who's working on something entirely different, to put a new light on things. People like Harry Nyquist could capture what someone was doing, throw some new ideas at them, and ask, "Why don't you try that?" When I visited groups for this book, I met a lot of people who possessed traits of warmth and curiosity. So many, in fact, that I began to think of them as Nyquists. They were polite, reserved, and skilled listeners. They radiated a safe, nurturing vibe. They possessed deep knowledge that spanned domains and had a knack for asking questions that ignited motivation and ideas. The best way to find the Nyquist is usually to ask people, "If I could get a sense of the way your culture works by meeting just one person, who would that person be?" If we think of successful cultures as engines of human cooperation, then the Nyquists are the spark plugs. The person I met who best embodied this process was named Roshi Gavici. Roshi Gavici works at the New York office of IDEO, the international design firm headquartered in Palo Alto, California. IDEO's place in the modern world is a little like that of Bell Labs. It has designed, among other things, the original Apple computer mouse, insulin pens for diabetics, and the stand-up toothpaste tube. It has won more design awards than any other company in history. The group consists of 600 people who are divided into small teams and tasked with meeting challenges that range from designing global plans for disaster response to building a smartphone charging handbag and everything in between. Officially, Givici is a designer. Unofficially, her role is to serve as roving catalyst, involved in a number of projects, helping the teams navigate the design process. When teams are stuck, or if there's a tough dynamic, Roshi is like magic, says Dwayne Bray, an IDEO partner. She's incredibly skilled at unlocking teams, asking questions that connect people and open possibilities. The truth is, we don't quite understand how she does it exactly. We just know that it works really well. Givici, a small woman in her 40s, wears flowing skirts with large pockets. She has dark, curly hair and quick, dark eyes with smile crinkles at the corners. On greeting, she makes no attempt to charm, no jokes, no extended small talk. She projects none of the energetic theatricality you encounter with many people in creative work. Instead, she radiates a contented stillness, as if you've met many times before. "Socially, I'm not the chattiest person," Givici says. "I love stories, but I'm not the person in the middle of the room telling the story. I'm the person on the side listening and asking questions. They're usually questions that might seem obvious or simple or unnecessary, but I love asking them because I'm trying to understand what's really going on." Givici's interactions with her teams take place largely in what IDEO calls flights, regular all-team meetings that occur at the start, middle, and finish of every project. Think of them as IDEO's version of the Brain Trust, or AAR. Givici approaches each flight from the outside in. She does her research, mostly through conversations, to learn the issues the team has been wrestling with, both from a design perspective, what are the barriers, and from a team dynamics perspective, where is the friction? Then, with that landscape in mind, she gathers the group and asks questions designed to unearth tensions and help the group gain clarity about themselves and the project. The word she uses for this process is surfacing. Halfway through our conversation, Givici asked me about this book's title and subtitle. I told her, and she paused. A long, meaningful pause. Then she asked, "Does that subtitle really work?" A few minutes later, after a few back and forths, this book had a new and improved subtitle. I'm not certain if I suggested the change or if she did. As Givici would say, we surfaced it together. "I like the word connect," Givici says. "For me, every conversation is the same, because it's about helping people walk away with a greater sense of awareness, excitement, and motivation to make an impact. Because individuals are really different. So you have to find different ways to make it comfortable and engaging for people to share what they're really thinking about. It's not about decisiveness, it's about discovery. For me, that has to do with asking the right questions the right way." Robert Bales, one of the first scientists to study group communication, discovered that while questions comprise only 6% of verbal interactions, they generate 60% of ensuing discussions. When you talk to Givici's colleagues, they point out a paradox. She's at once soft and hard, empathetic, but also persistent. "There's an underlying toughness to Roshi," says Lawrence Abrahamson, an IDEO design director. "She doesn't present an agenda, but of course there is an agenda behind that, and it's gentle guiding. And one of the biggest tools in her toolbox is time. She'll spend so much time being patient and continuing to have conversations and making sure the conversations are progressing in a good direction." "There's always a moment with Roshi," says Peter Antonelli, a design director. "There's a spirit of provocation constantly at play, to nudge, to help us think beyond what's immediately in front of us, and it usually starts with questioning the big, obvious things. It's never confrontational. She never says, "You're doing the wrong thing." It's organic, embedded in conversation. Watching Gavici listen is like watching a skilled athlete in action. She listens chiefly with her eyes, which have a Geiger counter-like sensitivity to changes in mood and expression. She detects small changes and responds to them swiftly. If you convey a scintilla of tension about a subject, she will mark it and follow up with a question designed to gently explore the reasons for that tension. When she speaks, she constantly links back to you with small phrases. Maybe you've had an experience like this. Your work might be similar. The reason I was pausing there was that provide a steady signal of connection. You find yourself comfortable opening up, taking risks, telling the truth. It feels like magic, but in fact, it's the result of a lot of practice. As a child, Gavici would use a cassette recorder to capture her voice reading her favorite books over and over, fascinated by the way tiny shifts in tone and timing could transform meaning. As a college student, studying psychology and design, she volunteered to assist the blind, and she wrote her college thesis on dance and choreography. She uses the idea of dance to describe the skills she employs with IDEO's design teams, to find the music, support her partner, and follow the rhythm. "I don't see myself as the conductor of the music," she says. "I'm more of a nudger. I nudge the choreography and try to create the conditions for good things to happen." A year ago, IDEO decided to scale Gavici's abilities across the organization. They asked her to create modules of questions teams could ask themselves, then provided those modules to design teams as tools to help them improve. For example, here are a few. "The one thing that excites me about this particular opportunity is..." "I confess, the one thing I'm not so excited about with this particular opportunity is..." "On this project, I'd really like to get better at..." The interesting thing about Gavici's questions is how transcendently simple they are. They have less to do with design than with connecting to deeper emotions, fear, ambition, motivation. It's easy to imagine that in different hands, these questions could fall flat and fail to ignite conversation. This is because the real power of the interaction is located in the two-way emotional signaling that creates an atmosphere of connection that surrounds the conversation. "The word subtle is the key," says Abrahamson. She's unassuming and disarms people because she is so open and listening and caring. Roshi has the ability to pause completely, to stop what must be going on in her head, to focus completely on the person and the question at hand, and to see where that question is leading. She isn't trying to drag you somewhere, ever. She's truly seeing you from your position, and that's her power. The word empathy sounds so soft and nice, but that's not what's really going on, says Jyoti Geetahi, a senior communication designer. What Roshi does requires a critical understanding of what makes people tick, and what makes people tick isn't always being nice to them. Part of it is that she knows people so well that she understands what they need. Sometimes what they need is support and praise, but sometimes what they need is a little knock on the chin, a reminder that they need to work harder, a nudge to try new things. That's what she gives. She's really listening, hearing what you said and asking what it means, digging deeper, says Neely Matuki, design researcher. She doesn't let things stay unclear, even when they're uncomfortable, especially when they're uncomfortable. Whereupon we must ask, what is inside that pause, that Nyquistian moment of vulnerable, authentic connection? That is, can we peer inside this moment and see what's really happening underneath? That's a question Dr. Carl Marcy has spent much of his career exploring. Marcy, a neurologist who teaches at Harvard, first became fascinated with listening in a medical school class that featured a series of non-Western healers. These healers were unconventional, employing a spectacular range of methods that were scientifically dubious. For example, giving massage where the hands didn't touch the patient, or administering drops of water with concentrations of ingredients that approached zero, and yet they achieved remarkable results. One reason, Marcy came to see, was the connection the healer formed with the patient. What these healers all had in common was that they were brilliant listeners. They would sit down, take a long patient history, and really get to know their patients, Marcy says. They were all incredibly empathic people who were really good at connecting with people and forming trusting bonds. So that's when I realized that the interesting part wasn't the healing, but the listening and the relationship being formed. That's what we needed to study. Marcy invented a method in which he videoed conversations while tracking galvanic skin response, the change in electrical resistance that measures emotional arousal. He discovered that for much of the time, the arousal curves of two people in conversation bore little or no relation to each other. But he also found special moments in certain conversations when the two curves fell into perfect sync. Marcy called these moments concordances. Concordances happen when one person can react in an authentic way to the emotion being projected in the room, Marcy says. It's about understanding in an empathic way, then doing something in terms of gesture, comment, or expression that creates a connection. One of the concordance videos included Marcy himself. He is seated in a chair facing an older man in a gray three-piece suit, who happens to be his therapist. Marcy is describing the day he proposed to his then-girlfriend. The machine sits between them, capturing the fluctuations of the inner landscape and projecting them onto the screen in the form of a pair of brightly colored shifting lines, blue for Marcy and green for the man in the gray suit. Marcy, we like to go to Bread and Circus and get their vegetable samosas. I said, well, I'll treat. We'll get some of those. So she figured we were going to have a picnic up there or something. Gray suit. Series of small, affirming nods. Marcy. The second thought she had was maybe, we'll occasionally go up there and watch the sunset. She said maybe there was something funky going on in the sky. Gray suit. Big, definitive nod. Marcy. And she said literally, for like a nanosecond, she entertained the idea that I was going to propose. But the idea went out faster than it went in. Gray suit. Sympathetic nod. Head tilt. Marcy. So she gets up there, and she's all dressed, looking stunning, as she always does, and she says, what's up? In hindsight, she was looking for food and couldn't find it. Gray suit. Small smile. Marcy. I said, come sit. I recited the first stanza of the E.E. Cummings poem, and it goes, being to timelessness as it's to time, love did no more begin than love will end. Gray suit. Head tilts upward, eyebrows up. Marcy, continuing to quote, where nothing is to breathe, to stroll, to swim, love is the air, the ocean, and the land. And I said, you are my air, and my ocean, and my land. Gray suit. Head tilt. Smile. Nod. Marcy. And it was just the most touching thing, because she realized what I was doing as I got the ring out, and just wept in a way that was so sincere and so earnest, and she was so overwhelmed. It was touching. It was nice. She was psyched. Gray suit. Small, affirming nods. Watching the video, the first thing you notice is that the conversation contains several moments of perfect concordance, where the green and blue lines move with a perfect coordination, rising and falling like pennants rippling in a breeze. The second thing you notice is that these moments happen without Gray Suit ever speaking a word. That is not to say that Gray Suit is not interacting, He radiates a steady attention, a poised stillness. His hands are folded on his lap. His eyes are up and alert. He reacts with nods, small expressions. In other words, he is doing what Roshi Gavichi does at IDEO and what Harry Nyquist presumably did at Bell Labs. He is demonstrating that the most important moments in conversation happen when one person is actively, intently listening. It's not an accident that concordance happens when there's one person talking and the other person listening, Marcy says. It's very hard to be empathic when you're talking. Talking is really complicated, because you're thinking and planning what you're going to say, and you tend to get stuck in your own head. But not when you're listening. When you're really listening, you lose time. There's no sense of yourself because it's not about you. It's all about this task, to connect completely to that person. Marcy has connected increases in concordances to increases in perceived empathy. The more concordances occur, the closer the two people feel. What's more, the changes in closeness happen not gradually, but all at once. There's often one moment where it happens, he says. There's an accelerated change to the relationship that happens when you're able to really listen, to be incredibly present with the person. It's like a breakthrough. We were like this, but now we're going to interact in a new way, and we both understand that it's happened. 12. Ideas for Action. Building habits of group vulnerability is like building a muscle. It takes time, repetition, and the willingness to feel pain in order to achieve gains. And as with building muscle, the first key is to approach the process with a plan. With that in mind, here are a few workout ideas for both individuals and groups. Make sure the leader is vulnerable first and often. As we've seen, group cooperation is created by small, frequently repeated moments of vulnerability. Of these, none carries more power than the moment when a leader signals vulnerability. As Dave Cooper says, "I screwed that up," are the most important words any leader can say. I saw a vivid example when I watched restaurateur Danny Meyer run one of his morning meetings with his staff, about 20 people. Meyer, whom we'll meet up close in Chapter 15, is the founder of Union Square Cafe, Shake Shack, Gramercy Tavern, and a number of other restaurants that together are worth more than $1 billion. The night before my visit, he had delivered his first ever TED Talk. The staff meeting began with the group watching a video of Meyer's speech. Then the lights went up, and Meyer spoke. "Can you see my leg shaking?" he asked the group. "I was so nervous, I was shaking like a leaf. I've given a lot of speeches, but the TED people wanted something more, something deeper and thoughtful. So I slept about 3 hours the night before, which is why I have those bags under my eyes. We had a terrible rehearsal, and I kept screwing up the PowerPoint. So it was almost a complete shit show. Except that I'm lucky enough to have some absolutely brilliant help." He paused and pointed. "Thanks, Chip and Haley. They made the whole thing work. They wrote great stuff, gave me great advice, and kept me together." Everyone looked at Chip and Haley and gave a short round of applause, while Meyer looked on approvingly. Meyer delivered the message, "I was scared," with steadiness, confidence, and comfort that underlined the deeper message, "It's safe to tell the truth here." His vulnerability isn't weakness, it's his strength. Laszlo Bock, former head of people analytics at Google, recommends that leaders ask their people three questions. "What is one thing that I currently do that you'd like me to continue to do? What is one thing that I don't currently do frequently enough that you think I should do more often? What can I do to make you more effective?" The key is to ask not for 5 or 10 things, but just one, Bock says. That way it's easier for people to answer. And when a leader asks for feedback in this way, it makes it safe for the people who work with them to do the same. It can get contagious. over-communicate expectations. The successful groups I visited did not presume that cooperation would happen on its own. Instead, they were explicit and persistent about sending big, clear signals that established those expectations, modeled cooperation, and aligned language and roles to maximize helping behavior. IDEO is a good example. Its leaders constantly talk about the expectation of cooperation. CEO Tim Brown incessantly repeats his mantra that the more complex the problem, the more help you need to solve it. They clearly define helping roles and model vulnerability. Their internal bulletin boards are filled with requests. Does anybody know of a good yoga class? Can anybody help me find a cat sitter for Christmas week? In case you missed those signals, they are also written in big letters both on the walls of the New York office and in the pages of the Little Book of IDEO, a copy of which is given to every employee. Among the refrains, collaborate and make others successful. Going out of your way to help others is the secret sauce. Deliver the negative stuff in person. This was an informal rule that I encountered at several cultures. It goes like this. If you have negative news or feedback to give someone, even as small as a rejected item on an expense report, you are obligated to deliver that news face to face. This rule is not easy to follow. It's far more comfortable for both the sender and receiver to communicate electronically, but it works because it deals with tension in an upfront, honest way that avoids misunderstandings and creates shared clarity and connection. One of the best methods for handling negative news is that of Joe Maddon, the coach of the Chicago Cubs and avowed enophile. In his office, Maddon keeps a glass bowl filled with slips of paper, each inscribed with the name of an expensive wine. When a player violates a team rule, Maddon asks them to draw a slip of paper out of the bowl, purchase that wine, and uncork it with their manager. In other words, Maddon links the act of discipline to the act of reconnection. When forming new groups, focus on two critical moments. Jeff Polzer, the Harvard Business School professor who studies organizational behavior, from Chapter 8, traces any group's cooperation norms to two critical moments that happen early in the group's life. They are 1. The first vulnerability. 2. The first disagreement. These small moments are doorways to two possible group paths. Are we about appearing strong or about exploring the landscape together? Are we about winning interactions or about learning together? At those moments, people either dig in and become defensive and start justifying, and a lot of tension gets created, Polzer says. Or they say something like, "Hey, that's interesting. Why don't you agree? I might be wrong, and I'm curious and want to talk about it some more." What happens in that moment helps set the pattern for everything that follows. Listen like a trampoline. Good listening is about more than nodding attentively. It's about adding insight and creating moments of mutual discovery. Jack Zanger and Joseph Folkman, who run a leadership consultancy, analyzed 3,492 participants in a manager development program and found that the most effective listeners do four things. 1. They interact in ways that make the other person feel safe and supported. 2. They take a helping, cooperative stance. 3. They occasionally ask questions that gently and constructively challenge old assumptions. 4. They make occasional suggestions to open up alternative paths. As Zenger and Folkman put it, the most effective listeners behave like trampolines. They aren't passive sponges. They are active responders, absorbing what the other person gives, supporting them, and adding energy to help the conversation gain velocity and altitude. Also like trampolines, effective listeners gain amplitude through repetition. When asking questions, they rarely stop at the first response. Rather, they find different ways to explore an area of tension in order to reveal the truths and connections that will enable cooperation. I've found that whenever you ask a question, the first response you get is usually not the answer. It's just the first response, Roshi Gavichi says. So I try to find ways to slowly surface things, to bring out what ought to be shared so that people can build from it. You have to find a lot of ways to ask the same question and approach the same question from a lot of different angles. Then you have to build questions from that response to explore more. In conversation, resist the temptation to reflexively add value. The most important part of creating vulnerability often resides not in what you say, but in what you do not say. This means having the willpower to forego easy opportunities to offer solutions and make suggestions. Skilled listeners do not interrupt with phrases like, "Hey, here's an idea," or, "Let me tell you what worked for me in a similar situation," because they understand that it's not about them. They use a repertoire of gestures and phrases that keep the other person talking. "One of the things I say most often is probably the simplest thing I say," says Gavichi. "Say more about that." It's not that suggestions are off limits. Rather, they should be made only after you establish what Gavichi calls a scaffold of thoughtfulness. The scaffold underlies the conversation, supporting the risks and vulnerabilities. With the scaffold, people will be supported in taking the risks that cooperation requires. Without it, the conversation collapses. Use candor-generating practices like AARs, brain trusts, and red teaming. While AARs were originally built for the military environment, the tool can be applied to other domains. One good AAR structure is to use 5 questions. 1. What were our intended results? 2. What were our actual results? 3. What caused our results? 4. What will we do the same next time? 5. What will we do differently? Some teams also use a before action review, which is built around a similar set of questions. 1. What are our intended results? 2. What challenges can we anticipate? 3. What have we or others learned from similar situations? 4. What will make us successful this time? A couple of tips. It may be useful to follow the SEALs' habit of running the AAR without leadership involvement to boost openness and honesty. Likewise, it may be useful to write down the findings, particularly what will be done the same or differently next time, and share them across the group. After all, the goal of an AAR is not just to figure out what happened, but also to build a shared mental model that helps the group navigate future problems. Brain trusts, the project-based method pioneered by Pixar, involve assembling a team of experienced leaders who have no formal authority over the project and letting them critique its strengths and weaknesses in a frank and open manner. A key rule of brain trusts is that the team is not allowed to suggest solutions, only to highlight problems. This rule maintains the project leader's ownership of the task and helps prevent them from assuming a passive, order-taking role. Red teaming is a military-derived method for testing strategies. You create a red team to come up with ideas to disrupt or defeat your proposed plan. The key is to select a red team that is not wedded to the existing plan in any way, and to give them freedom to think in new ways that the planners might not have anticipated. AARs, brain trusts, and red teams each generate the same underlying action: to build the habit of opening up vulnerabilities so that the group can better understand what works, what doesn't work, and how to get better. Aim for candor. Avoid brutal honesty. Giving honest feedback is tricky because it can easily result in people feeling hurt or demoralized. One useful distinction, made most clearly at Pixar, is to aim for candor and avoid brutal honesty. By aiming for candor, feedback that is smaller, more targeted,